kind of named the show Decoding Our Past, because after all of the Horizon Project and listening to your speak, what it spoke to me of was trying to understand our ancient history. And during your talk there, you mentioned some of the keys to understanding our ancient history. I wonder if you could speak on what some of those keys are.
Well, the whole idea, again, is to have an open mind. You got to start with that. And, of course, then you do bring a scientific attitude. You look at what's there. It's not unscientific, you see, to study the ancient myths. This is what Joseph Campbell and others of his ilk, particularly Carl Jung and Mircea Eliade, and, there's been others, but these are the heavyweights. They were scientists. They were absolutely scientists at the top of the totem pole. And these are people who then understood, and Sigmund Freud, of course, jumps to mind as well. These are people who had absolutely no problem. I mean, there's a reason why all of Freud's psychological complexes and drives and syndromes are named after Greek mythological characters. And the reason is because Freud was a genius in Greek mythology and completely understood what mythology is about, and that man carries his own in the unconscious. He's carrying around, you see, in his race memory, scientifically speaking, in his DNA, and in New Age parlance, in his Akashic record, you see, whatever terminology you want to use, man is a walking scriptorium of the past. So when you're studying what you think is the past, meaning when you're studying history, you're studying yourself. Man is studying his self. It's man studying man. That's what is so important about the subject of history, because it's how we came to be who we are. It's the actions of a human being or a group of human beings, and it can be seen, in 3D by the study of history. Now, of course, history has been also deeply manipulated. The subject of history is no more than about 200 years old, and study of Bible history, for instance, is even, younger than that. So we haven't got very far in the sense, we have got far, if you consider in the short time what we know, yeah. But, the subjects themselves are not very old. And therefore, it behoves man to discover who he is. And that's the subject of psychology, that involves study of sociology, that is involving history. And you bring to it, like Jung did, like Freud did, like great authors will do, you bring to it your scientific reason, your rational, your rational understanding, and you look into the historical record. And many, many great people have done this. Professor Tolkien did it, and he chose then to write about many of his discoveries or the books that he had access to in, the university that maybe, other people would never have got to see. He chose to express what he understood about ancient history in fiction, and that's perfectly fine. That's been done by many people. And, I go to the length of saying that if a person does not discover their history, and they can start with their own race or their own nation or their own family, you're lacking roots. You're lacking roots. And when you lack roots, well, then the sorcerers who rule our world, and there's really no other word for these people that fits them better, they are all the more easy to blow you down. So if you want to be, an existentially vagrant person without any roots who can be totally demolished by these crime families and the nonsense that they create for you. If you want to be that hollow, shallow, like the hollow man, of T.S. Eliot's poem, by all means do so. But if you don't want to be like that and you want some sense of center, it's very important to have these kinds of roots. And more so, it's important to realize that whether you study history or not, you are the product of history. You carry around your ancestry in your own unconscious. And therefore, if you want to be a full human being and incorporate the unconscious, which is very important for psychological growth, then, you see, you're going to have to access that reservoir, that Akashic record, that race memory within yourself. And the system does not want you to do that. So the schools were set up, the universities are set up, these abattoirs of the mind were set up so that a person will be absolutely trained, whipped into shape. If you're going to study these subjects, they're going to make sure that you study it in the most dry, meaningless, mundane, mediocre, shallow way, and that you end up, by the time you're 18, you absolutely hate these subjects. The last thing you want to, delve into. And this is something that we have a problem with in the alternative research community. because many of speakers like myself and writers like myself will constantly be using historical anecdotes. But you're often doing it to an audience who hasn't got the faintest idea, and worse, hasn't the faintest interest in what you're talking about. So this is a big problem then. So that it's quite a lot of effort for a person to, you know, cut it up into small pieces for people so that they get it and also start to learn to love the subject again and realize the depth of it and to start creating these roots that have been so, you know, adroitly torn up by the world order.
I mean, when you look around now, I get together with a group and we discuss different topics and stuff a couple of times a week and just networking with other like-minded people. And I sometimes ask the question, have we regressed or are we evolving? Which is it? Because when you look around, sometimes it's like, well, geez, I don't know. By the looks of it, we've more regressed than what we've evolved. Because when you look back and some of the things that you were talking about during that talk, things like the pyramids and stuff, man, we couldn't even build those now.
We have regressed in ways that it's just hard to fathom. Monumentally so.
Yeah.
Monumentally so. Exactly as you point out. Purely even from a practical capacity, that alone. Now, we have a great idea in our minds that we're ever so advanced and we are so sane and we are so privileged and we are so special. That's just an idea, and that's been well and truly implanted in us by some very adroit mind controllers. The fact of the matter is we are so unbelievably primitive, it's hard to even fathom, really. And, you know, nobody's eyes are really open until this can be seen, the kind of atrocities that man has done. And the thing is also that you have to understand also that what is regression? You know, why would one have regressed as opposed to progress? Okay, there's this external force that is responsible. That's also, you know, important to recognize that it's like a double-headed eagle. I'm not saying that no external force. In fact, my work is often to point out the external agencies that have also conspired to keep man in an ignorant state. But those forces can't do it on their own. Man must also want some basic level, you see, to remain in a regressed state. And it's very, very simple to explain, and that is that there is a thing called reality, and there is a thing called unreality or fantasy. And it's in a person's life, take a character who's living, at some point in their life, and it really can be early, it can be in their infancy. I mean, literally, regression can take place at any point in a person's life. They will find it impossible to deal with reality, mostly because some sort of pain or discomfort is involved. And that can happen at 9 years of age, it can happen at 13, certainly it happens at the rites of passage, when a person will become static. And they first become static because reality as it is, it becomes intolerable. It's like a wall. It's like a wall. And when that person cannot no longer negotiate reality, which takes in a tremendous amount of willpower and courage to do so, then they either remain static, or since nature doesn't like a vacuum, they'll start to regress. And it's one of the most well-known psychological phenomena, and one of the worst, one of the hardest, believe it or not, repression and regression. And regression is considered one of the hardest nuts to crack if you're a psychologist. That repression is much easier to fix most of the other psychological complexes. Now, what would happen if, as you say, the human race, is regressing? People still believe this nonsense of these official religions, the utter bogusness and utter fakery and forgery and mass murder, murdering philosophies, ideologies. They still are buying into it now, especially in American context, more than they've ever done before. Isn't that a form of regression? Almost like mankind has taken one step forward and 10 steps back.
Yeah. Is it just a simple matter of one not wanting to take responsibility or what? Or are we just so dumbed down?
Well, let's again look at it let's take an individual who can't move forward for some reason because of some terrible trauma that's taken place. And then let's say that there is an entire culture of trauma being manufactured out there. I mean, I keep talking about this in my work in order to try and stop people who are into my work from buying into this trauma. By God, it's almost impossible. It's like trying to unfreeze. It's incredible. How can you stop these people buying into trauma? We have an entire media network, a media monopoly. We have a government right now, and of course, it's not ultimately, if you study history, there's nothing new with what's going on. Mm-hmm. This kind of trauma has been going on since biblical times. I mean, you know, the Roman army, you know, I mean, you can take it back that the powers that be always are injecting fear and trauma and worry and all sorts of mayhem into the body politic to keep people frozen with fear. And that barrage of trauma drip-fed to you every day through the television, drip-fed to you, you know, by governments who are always rumors of war and all this kind of thing, added to your own personal trauma, yeah, that will literally do the trick. And the psychologists are, and most of the intellectuals of the world are entirely, in my book, you know, deficient, because they're not constantly waking people up to this. That, yes, there's legitimate things to be afraid of, but fear is a very different emotion than anxiety. What we're talking about here is anxiety. That people have, you know, or stress is the code, the key word now in our culture, you know. And we have to identify these areas of why this would be. Part of it is the constant drip feed, as I'm saying, from the environment. Because I believe that the traumas that arise in your own personal life probably would not be enough to have you become static or regress. It does happen in certain individuals' lives, people who just don't have the hardwiring, and they don't have the willpower, or, of course, if the traumas that are happening in their life are so extreme, which can happen in a minimum of cases, they've literally endured such utter agony, that in those cases, of course, you can't blame the person for regressing. But on the whole, for most people, there's not going to be that much intensity of difficulty that they can't overcome. Human beings are pretty resilient. So I look at it as a combination of things. It's the normal stresses and hassles and trauma of daily life that arises in a man's life. But I believe it's also compounded massively by the culture and environment of stress that's not picked up consciously, but is there unconsciously. And so my work always, you know, tends to emphasize this, to make people sort of aware of all of this so that they have defenses against it. Because if you don't, then we are sunk as a civilization. You know, and then, of course, you'd have to take the pessimistic view of people like Sigmund Freud, who just absolutely held out no hope for the human race, that they saw that man was just a vicious, brutal, limbic creature who's heading for disaster. Yeah. And if he doesn't, you know, very much maintain his morals, maintain his virtues, connect with his deep roots, study history, etc. And none of these things we're seeing happening. We're seeing man getting more artificialized, more traumatized, more superficial and shallow. It's hard to even fathom. In fact, I have difficulty imagining a future in which people are more shallow than they are now. So I can't answer you. You know, I mean, it looks as bad to me now as it ever could be, with some beautiful, you know, exceptions to that, of course. Yeah. I'm not painting it all black. But I'm saying that generally what's walking around in the streets, and we've talked about this before, is pretty rotten. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a scary... for myself, I have a... I don't know whether this is a paradox or not, but it's like I have no faith in man, but I have faith in myself.
Well, ultimately, that's all you can have faith in. We're not responsible for each other. People have their own karmas. You don't know where they're coming from, you know, and that you must care for others. You must care for the spirit of humanity. But that doesn't mean that you lose your own sovereignty or your own, you know, welfare by running after other people and laying your soul out like a red carpet. You know, that's not. You can be a signpost for other people to point the way, but you cannot walk the road for them. You know?
Yeah, can't lead a horse to drink the water that you take it to.
No, in fact, that's a violation of their own sovereignty, in fact.
You're taking their power away from them.
Precisely, yeah. Which is exactly, unfortunately, what's going on in what we call relationships today of all kinds. Big Brother has taken away from us a responsibility. No, of course, we often give it up because, again, of this feeling of impotency within ourselves. If you're not strong, it's like the first chapter of my Irish Origins book goes into this, that the existentially weakened man is going to be desiring the stabilizers and the handrails that the system provides. We are putting in power the very leaders that are, you know, are helping to destroy us and destroy the planet.
That's the weird thing that I can't wrap my mind around. It's like, well, it just astounds me that not only are we so forgetful of some of the atrocities that these people that we end up putting in power have done in the past, that we still enable them and put them back in power, but it just amazes me that people just stand around like an ostrich with their head in their ground. The apathy is just blows me away.
Yeah. And it's strange to think that Goethe, you know, Wolfgang von Goethe was talking about this in the 1700s. Other philosophers have been talking about this fall off of man. Shakespeare, for goodness sake, was talking about it in Hamlet, you know, in the 1600s, 16th century, I mean. Tennyson spoke about it in the early, in the latter part of the 19th century, 1800s. We've had other seers, mystics, philosophers, predictors. We've gone through an entire existential phase of philosophy in which all of these points were brought out about the utter, you know, emptiness and futility of human beings. I mean, and people still ain't getting it. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's phenomenal to me just how much forgetfulness there is, and I can only think that this is part, again, of this, you know, this is a legacy of living by constant. It's like a feedback loop. Mm-hmm. The more existentially weak a person becomes, the more likely they are to put tyrants on the throne. Those tyrants on the thrones of the world then work overtime to continue to keep you like a you know, brainless pawn. So it becomes a feedback loop in which almost there's no breaking. There's no breaking of it. It's very difficult. It's very, very difficult.
Michael, it's Lynn. Hi. One comment. Civilizations, when you talk about history, which happens to be something I love, is the interesting thing that every civilization that we are looking at, the remnants of, the pyramids, the Aztecs, all of them, and no one can figure out what happened to them. And they were all at the epitome, supposed, the epitome of their civilization. And then it all, the house of cards came down, and they're gone, which is interesting because that appears to be where we are right now, aren't we?
I think so. I really do. And again, I tend to put my needle of focus on the psychological aspect, but you're absolutely right. The Maya have talked about the great ages of creation. The Zuni and Hopi have talked about it. Most of the Native American Indian groups talk about this, rise and fall of civilizations. We have Vico, we have Plato, we have Edward Gibbon even talked about it in modern times. The Vedic system talks about the great Mahayugas and the fact that, you know, there are four main yugas that come to their peak and then close, you know, the cycles of time, in other words. I don't think you can find a culture that doesn't speak about this. Everything does move in orbits or cycles, so we know that there's, you know, a high point and a low point of everything, including the movement of the planets and the stars. And it's the same with the ins and outs of the human psyche. There's times when the ego is strong and bright, and man is rational and sane and upward moving, like, you know, somebody would point to the Grecian era and the tremendous discoveries, you know, that were made then, and the freedoms and the philosophies and the scientific advancements, and then followed by a dark age in which, you know, society plunges into unbelievable, you know, ignorance, etc. So it seems that there is this ebb and flow. So I tend to look at it not as something, in a way, it's on a meta level, maybe it's natural. Maybe the river has to, you know, narrow and widen. Maybe there is an anabolic and a catabolic phase. And maybe great wisdom is in understanding that, as opposed to going, well, it all should just be one, you know, canal. Mm-hmm. It should never vary, you know. Yeah, well, that's for canals and that's for train tracks, but it's not for history. It's not for consciousness, you know. Maybe there is this, creation, deconstruction, you know, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. I mean, it's there. It's in the mythologies. And the scientists talk about entropy. You know, and we see even in the human life, we have these five or six different, phases of human life. And, of course, the hero with a thousand faces, you know, are the three stages of the feminine cycle, where there's the crone and the young virgin, you see in the matron, you know, how it goes. So in every aspect of life, you're seeing this kind of cycle, you know, Horus and Osiris, you know, and a sort of the three stages of the sun and what have you, and the 12 stages of the underworld. So the ancients were telling us about this, that there is a rhythm, and maybe greater wisdom comes in understanding that rhythm and allowing it, as opposed to trying to create, you know, straight roads, you know. And maybe it's like William Blake said, it's the straight roads are the roads of invention, but the windy roads, the crooked roads, are the roads of imagination.
Yes, I like that. Yeah, that's kind of where I sit is, I think that we just have to, you know, see, this is the question that I posed to one of our groups one week was, I asked a question, and it really got everybody's back up. I was amazed at the change, the change in the dynamics of the whole group. When my question was, why is the past so important? And I mean, you've gone on to a lot of those reasons why, because that was kind of where I was going with that. Because it's sometimes, do we center too much on the past instead of going with which I feel is the most important, which is the present? Shouldn't that be what we're concentrating on? Does that make sense?
Yeah, ultimately. But unfortunately, we're in a state of, you know, there's so much chronic ignorance that it's almost inevitable that we learn from the lessons of the past, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that philosophically speaking, it's wonderful to talk about being in the now. But you see, that takes a very, very pure and unadulterated kind of consciousness to be able to do that. It's not something that's simple. You know what I mean? And collectively, sociologically, when we're talking about the mass of the human race, it is important to, I believe, to, you know, talk about this because to focus on the past. It's not pathologically. See, in my consciousness, I'm always thinking in terms of the mountain peak, that the person who is the philosopher, the person who's asking the questions, he is already at the position where he has the best of those both worlds. He's ascending the mountain, he's standing on the peak, and from that peak he can see the view of the past and he can also see ahead. So he's in a good position. There's no reason for him to be, limited. There's no reason for him to be narrow in his vision. Now, if you're talking about the person who's down in the stinking little village in the valley, well, that person couldn't care less. So in a way, their pragmatism does leave them in the present, but not in a good way.
Yeah.
They're in the present because they're in escapism. They're in the present because, oh, you know, whatever I do today, the beer that's on my table today, what's on TV today, what's the latest, what's the latest gimmick or garbage that can be put in front of me to entertain me in this moment? I'm not interested in where I've come from. I'm not interested in where I'm going. They're in the present, but they're in a present in a most pathological sense. So I wouldn't say that it's wholly important to live or dwell in the past, because remember, then, if you do that, if you live in the past exclusively, then you've regressed.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're a person who's in a, you know, it's like a lot of these people who are habitually obsessed with stuff in the past, who go collecting old trains, or they're obsessed by a particular era, you know. These are people who've regressed, but they've sublimated it, meaning that they have a fancy cover for their regression, because the ego also doesn't like to admit that it's regressed, so it finds all sorts of cool ways. You know, often it's an obsession with things from the past, like collecting old stamps, or, you know, there's a whole, I mean, people who've read Jung and Freud will know this, that there's 101 ways for a person to cover up the fact that they've regressed, which might look sociologically wonderful, like they become an expert on, you know, a Flemish painting or whatever. I'm just pulling things out of the hat here, but, you know, there's all sorts of ways that a man can regress and then make it culturally acceptable that he's regressed.
Yeah.
You see this all around us, in fact.
That makes sense to me, that, yeah, that there's certain plateaus while you're going up to the peak of the mountaintop that you have to go through before you get to the peak.
Yes, you do. And, you see, our vision is already limited incredibly. You know, Isaac Newton, at the end of his life, says that I feel like I am just a small boy kicking over stones or picking up stones on the beach while the whole ocean of knowledge lies in front of me. And, you know, it's probably one of the only things that I agree with in what he said, and it's very, very true. So our perspective as a human being is already amazingly limited. Our faculties have been so dumbed down. I mean, the scientists, biologists know that there's 37 sensory inputs to the brain, and yet we use 5 of those, you know, senses.
Wow.
And of course people will go, well, there's my reason then for taking drugs, or, you know, that's my reason for taking ayahuasca or whatever. I'm opening all those centers. But let's leave that whole question aside. Other people may do yogas, you know, people who've sort of aware of this a little bit and say, look, okay, then I'm really going to make an effort, you know, but I don't want to get into commentary about that. All I'm saying is that there's so many other centers of awareness that have been cut off from the human being, you know, and so our perspectives are already tremendously limited. I believe it's good exercise, not something to be obsessed about, but it's good exercise to, you know, examine the past in a certain way. You don't let go of your reason, you don't become obsessed or regressed, but you exercise it and you use your rational. You know, like, for instance, as I said, history's been manipulated, so I specialize mostly in the alternative history. I study how history has been manipulated. That's an incredible exercise.
Yeah.
I find that to be exceptionally important on the path of enlightenment. I don't see any different. Yeah, I see that study as a yoga.
It is certainly a type of yoga, absolutely. And I think the quest for truth in any form is a helpful thing.
You got it. That I think you've summed it up. It's really the quest is for truth. And when you look into the archive of the past, not only are you likely to be turned on to men of truth, fantastic men of truth,
mm-hmm.
that would just dumbfound your, you know, your wildest dreams, right? You know, and don't even get me started with the list. But the thing is that, you know, you're likely to then be in the classroom of classrooms. You're going to have the teachers, you know, that, I mean, you couldn't even imagine.
Yeah.
Your wildest dreams come true. And that will help you make up for the garbage that's been taught to you while you've been alive, and that your unfortunate parents stuck you in front of these tyrants of lies. Unfortunately, you have to make up for that. One thing about studying the past is that you may come across the Pythagorean, you know, concepts, and you know, you may be exalted by the Professor Tolkien's, you see, and the whole world of people that are available to you through the books and so forth and so on, you know, and awaken that way. It's such a tremendous exercise for the mind.
And I think, like you say, it's so darn important. We're going to take our next break. And when we come back, I want to get into time and talk about time for a bit. He's one of my favorite artists. He's just an amazing poet and activist and environmentalist. And this is John Trudell and Bone Days. Enjoy it.